short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Pretty soon, you or someone in your household should be getting a postcard inviting you to go online to fill out some information about everyone who lives in your home. You'll be required to fill in your name, age, sex, race, and if you have Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish origin. If you don't fill out the form online, you will find a paper form in your mailbox. If you don't fill that out, you should expect a knock on the door. This is, of course, for the 2020 federal census. The first American residents will start to be counted in January, when remote Alaskan communities start to see the outreach. Those postcards I mentioned with information on how to fill out the form online will hit most of our mailboxes in March. You might have been clued into some of the controversy earlier this year about whether or not to include a citizenship question on the form. The Trump administration wanted to differentiate within the questionnaire, but ultimately that question is not included. We actually have a link to a sample form on our show page at VPR if you want to see what is included. You can just click on today's Vermont edition to see it. And there you can also add your questions or your comments about census preparation. And we're going to spend the next half hour or so talking about preparations underway in Vermont to make sure everyone in our state is counted. Governor Scott recently announced the formation of the Vermont 2020 Complete Count Committee that's designed to do just that. And our guest today, Michael Moser, is on that committee, which makes a lot of sense because he's also the coordinator of the Vermont State Census Data Center at UVM's Center for Rural Studies. Michael, welcome to the program. It's nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Can you just explain some general details about the census before we get into Vermont preparations? What is the purpose of the 10-year census?
Well, essentially, it started out as a way to understand how many Americans, how many people were living in America. And since 1790 or so, we've been sending people out across the country. The federal government has been and has been asking people to enumerate themselves, to count themselves. And those data were primarily used for representation at the federal level in, through the Senate and the House of Representatives. And so, you know, that's the original purpose.
Original and current?
Ongoing purpose. There's a lot of other ways that Census Bureau data is used now, decennial census data, as well as other data products that the Census Bureau puts together and ask questions about.
But the ultimate purpose is just to know how many people are living in the U.S. and who they are?
That's sort of the overarching. That's the original purpose. These days, we do use the data to look at federal spending programs and to apportion federal tax dollars back to the states. So essentially for every person that we count in the state of Vermont or anywhere in the United States, that every person that's counted is means that there's additional federal dollars coming back to the state in the form of a variety of different federal programs.
And not negligible dollars, right? I mean, how much federal money per person does Vermont tend to get?
Oh, it's a lot. There's a recent study by the George Washington University that looks at federal dollars going back to the states. It looks at about 55 different federal spending programs. And for Vermont recently, we're a net recipient of federal dollars. We receive more than we actually put into the system. But we're talking about somewhere around $4,000 per person in Vermont that comes back per year in the form of federal transportation dollars, Medicaid, Medicare, HUD, Housing and Urban Development Funds, all of these different programs. Yep.
So there's some incentive for the state to make sure that every person in Vermont is also counted just because, you know, it means a difference in federal dollars coming into the state.
Without a doubt, there's a very strong incentive for us to make sure that we count every Vermonter every person that's living in our state.
Well, and that's a key question here and one that has really been the subject of controversy, not whether or not people should be counted, but how they're characterized and categorized within the census. The census is not designed just to count citizens. It's
Correct.
Designed to count everybody living in the United States?
Residents, people who are living in the United States or in this geography, yes.
And what might be the purpose behind asking or not asking citizenship status?
Well, the Census Bureau does ask about citizenship status already in other surveys and has asked about citizenship status in previous decennial censuses. So the controversy there is understandable based on where it was coming from. And
what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, coming from the executive branch at a time when there's a lot of other policies that are being pushed that would seem to be counterproductive to being inclusive to all residents in our country.
And a lot of people who opposed this question said this is likely to result in people not filling out the census because they don't want to put their citizenship status on the form. So they might not fill it out at all, which would result in significant undercounting of the number of people in this country. And, you know, whether or not that is the ultimate goal or was the ultimate goal of that question in the first place is a political conversation that's been ongoing. But a lot of people who were worried about the question said this would actually result in undercounting. Does that seem likely?
Yeah, I think just because the citizenship question, well, it's not on this, it's not going to be on this decennial census. But just the fact that it was thrown into question, I think, has had a chilling effect on populations that may have already had concerns about providing their information to the federal government. And there's lots of different populations, lots of different groups of people across the country who might not feel secure in doing that. And so Just that having that conversation has contributed to a chilling effect for the responses.
Michael, can we talk a little bit about what actually is in the form? And I'm holding a sample copy, informational copy, and we have a link to this on our show page for today so people can see it. It's not a lot of information.
No, it's not. So just a little bit of history or context. So up until 2010, the Census Bureau had two different forms. They had this long form and the short form. That's what they were referred to. The long form asked a lot of really detailed questions about the household, like getting down to the level of, you know, internet access and questions, really detailed questions about the physical conditions of the house and things like that. That's gone away now. And the Census Bureau is collecting those data on the American Community Survey, which is an ongoing study that's just continuously sampling the populations across the country. This decennial census, the 2020 decennial census, is just comprised of a short form and is really asking 9 or 10 questions of immediate importance to the Census Bureau. It actually acts as a kind of a foundation for all of the Census Bureau statistical operations that they run. So this is sort of like a cross-check with what they think they know about the U.S. population. They can ask these questions and then use these data to then merge with other data sets and other surveys that they're conducting all the time.
Do they get a different level of response from this than from that community information survey? I mean, is there a reason not to do them at the same time?
So the American Community Survey, again, it's constantly being asked. They're constantly surveying folks across Vermont, across the country. There are people in Vermont that are Census Bureau employees that are always out there knocking on doors or making calls and gathering information. So the decennial census form is really just an opportunity to sort of provide that foundation.
And the information that you'll be expected to provide is how many people are in your household, how many live there full-time versus semi-permanently or only temporarily. Is it a house, apartment, or a mobile home? You'll have to provide the name, the sex, and the age of each person. And then you'll have two questions. One is this person of Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish origin, and what is the person's race? So there are 9 questions only, and you fill them out for each person in the household, or the head of household is supposed to do that.
Yep.
So what happens if you don't fill it out? Is it actually legally required?
Yes, you're supposed to fill out your decennial census form, and the Census Bureau goes to great lengths to make sure that they're going to collect as much information directly from the household as they can. So, as you mentioned earlier at the top of the show, they're going to send out a postcard with an internet response option. So this is the first time – this is actually big news. This is the first time the Census Bureau will be enabling folks to enter their information online, secure website, secure servers, and to fill out the form. Might take you 5-10 minutes depending on how many people are in your household. It's really simple, really straightforward. You just plug in the website and there can be a code that'll match your household up with the, you know, the postcard and the response, and then you just fill out the form and you can sort of, you know, walk away from it and not have to think about the decennial census anymore. If you opt not to do the internet response, then you'll receive another form, as you said, with a paper copy that you can fill out, and it's self-addressed, self-stamped. So you just fold it up, send it back in the mail, and that can be taken care of. Another response option is you can call in and talk to folks on the phone and respond that way. And if you still don't respond via internet or via paper, then eventually someone's going to come knocking on your door. And maybe you don't want a federal employee coming to your house. Maybe you're concerned about that. Maybe you don't want someone interviewing you at your home. So the best way to avoid that is just to do it online or fill out the paper copy and send it back in.
But what if you don't do any of that? I mean, will you eventually get in trouble?
The Census Bureau does not go after people like that. That's not their job. They're a statistical agency. What the Census Bureau will do is they will do everything in their power to try and ascertain who lives in the household, a housing unit that they see is occupied. And they'll talk to folks in the community if they need to and try to determine if there is someone living there and, you know, what the characteristics of that household are as best they can. They also do end up using a variety of administrative records to help them as a backstop if they're missing data or they can't find any information for a household. They may go to a variety of administrative records. They collaborate with the Internal Revenue Service, for example, to see if they can find some information that way.
Michael, let me ask you a little bit about what the hurdles are to getting everyone in Vermont counted. I mean, are there sort of general things that might prevent a full and accurate count here?
I think the reason that we've developed this Complete Count Commission is to reach the hard to reach communities, and there are several different communities in the state or across the country that are proved to be a little bit more difficult to reach than others, and those include very young children. They include people of color, the LGBTQ community. They include folks who may have distrust of federal government for various reasons. And so, you know, it's our job to really help them understand the repercussions of not responding and why it's important to them and to our communities to respond to the census.
Is it accurate to say that there are sort of two categories of people who are likely undercounted? And one category is people who never actually get the form or who are for some reason not counted within a household. And then the other bucket of people are people who may have the form but don't want to fill it out for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think sort of the overarching themes. Yeah, there's folks who just don't want to provide their data and or are distrustful for various reasons. And then folks that maybe aren't even aware that someone's trying to figure out where they live and who they are a little bit. Transitory folks that are highly mobile or transitory folks that are experiencing homelessness are a good example of a population that you know, the Census Bureau does special programming to go out and try and reach those folks. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, John, I think we have back on the line in Burlington. And John, I think your question was about how homeless Vermonters
yes.
might be counted, right?
Exactly. The household unit is fine, but if you don't have a house, you know, how do they count? You answered the question, I guess.
Yeah, John, thanks. And actually, the census question does ask about people who are staying at your house but might not have any other place to live, right? I mean, isn't that partly included in it?
Yeah, absolutely. The Census Bureau has a special operation that they run in collaboration with organizations that serve the populations that are experiencing homelessness. And so there's one night that the Census Bureau actually goes out into the communities and canvasses all of these different locations, whether it be food service locations or overnight shelters, warming shelters. And they work very closely with agencies and entities that are serving these populations so that they can make sure to make these counts as accurate as possible.
Wendy's calling in also from Burlington. Wendy, do you have a question or an idea?
Yes, you spoke about the potential for undercounting young children, and I'm particularly concerned about that, as I understand it happened with the 2010 census. I'm wondering if you can say anything about how that played out in terms of funding, either in Vermont or nationally, for programs like Medicaid and food programs, and particularly the impact on families with young children.
Michael?
I don't think I can say anything about the impact, but I can say that it's of utmost importance to the folks at the Census Bureau to address the undercount of very young children across the country. They have statisticians, they have teams that are focused just on that particular issue, because it is actually the group that is that experiences the largest percentage of undercount, around 4% undercount. And so they are very aware of this and working very hard to ensure that, you know, when people are responding to the form, that they're taking into account children that may not be physically in the house with them at that time, but maybe should be counted by them or should be counted somewhere, obviously. And I think generally speaking, the impact is for, you know, for every Vermont resident that we don't count, again, that's somewhere in the vicinity of $4,000 per year in federal dollars coming back to the state that we might be missing in a variety of programs.
And Michael, you don't know why it's particularly acute for children under the age of four. I mean, one reason that children might not be counted is if there are minors living in households where there's a shared custody agreement and there's two different households that the kids live in at different times. But that doesn't just apply to very young children.
You're absolutely right. And I honestly, I'm not sure all of the reasons that the very youngest children are undercounted. I've seen a variety of reasons listed, and non-traditional households is sort of one of, and I'd like to put that in air quotes if I could, but non-traditional households is one of the biggest reasons that children get missed when people are filling out the forms. You know, it could be that a child is living at someone else's home half the time, whatever, yeah.
Another particularly vulnerable population when it comes to undercounting are people who are senior citizens. And joining us now is Elliot Greenblatt, who's coordinator of AARP's Fraud Watch program in Vermont. Elliot, it's nice to have you on the program.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
So why are older Vermonters going to face difficulty potentially, or why does the federal government face difficulty in counting older American residents, and how are we going to fix that in Vermont?
I think one of the issues is that so many Vermont elders live alone, live in isolated places, tend to get a lot of junk mail, and maybe looking at something that comes from the Census Bureau as just another piece of junk mail.
Is that the only reason that they're living alone? I mean, the census is supposed to go to people who are living in group home situations, whether that's any kind of group home situation, but particularly those for elderly Vermonters. But so are they just not responding, or are they not actually getting counted for some reason, not even getting the form?
Yeah, in the case of group settings, quite often the management of those group homes, it might be an assisted living facility, a nursing home, they will work with the seniors in their location and make sure those forms are completed. Same thing's true with activities such as voter registration. So we don't see that kind of problem coming out of the group situation. I think it's more the large number of Vermonters who live in isolated environments that may not be counted as easily.
You are the coordinator of AARP Vermont's Fraud Watch program, and there are some concerns about fraudulent people trying to pass themselves off as connected to the census. So what should people be on the lookout for that might look like the census but is not?
Well, the approaches that were being made aware of as far as scammers are concerned are in-person visits where an individual walks up to your door and says, I'm representative of the census. I have some questions for you to respond to. There will be some personal visits that way, but if somebody does come to your door, what we're saying is check to make sure they have a valid ID. and that would be an ID issued by the U.S. government. It's going to have a watermark on it from the Department of the Census. And what might be considered kind of unique is the individual's employment is identified with an expiration date. So if somebody does come to your door, that's one way to address it. If you have a question and you say, can you come back, that would be an appropriate way to address it. And then you can call the New York Regional Office for the Census, which is number is 800-991-2520. And by calling that number, you can verify the identity of the individual who comes to your door.
Let me stop you there, Elliot. We have Elliot. Let me stop you for a second. We've got a call from
email.
Hang on, Elliot. I'm not sure you can hear me, but I want to make sure we get a call here from Nancy, because Nancy might have a question related to what you've just been talking about. And Nancy, go right ahead. I want to hear your question.
Yes. Well, it was more of a comment. I live in Warren and on a dead end dirt road. This summer, we had a gentleman stop by who said he was from the census and just checking the records and making sure what he had was accurate. I thought that was a little strange, but within another week or 10 days, a woman stopped by and I said, well, you know, someone was just here. Well, she was the supervisor and she was just checking to make sure his work was correct. I assume both people were being paid, and to have two people come to our house on a dead end dirt road this summer just seems like kind of overkill and a waste of time and money.
So, Nancy, let me ask your question to Elliot Greenblatt. Elliot, is Nancy potentially a victim of the kind of scam that you were talking about, or are there people who may be coming by to check on census data prior to 2020?
There are people who will come by far ahead of the 2020 date, which is April 1st. So it's not unusual, for instance, for verification of housing locations to take place. Supervisors will come around and check to make sure that the individual had visited your house. So that's a possibility. There are also other activities that the Census Bureau gets involved with that aren't related to the decennial. For instance, the American Community Survey is conducted every year, several times a year. So it's quite likely that that would happen. But again, if somebody does come and say, I'm a representative of the U.S. Census, they should have an identification card. You should be able to identify very quickly to see if it's valid. And then if you have questions, don't answer their questions. Contact the Census office.
So let's go to Anna calling in from Weybridge now. Anna, go right ahead.
Hi. 10 years ago, I was a census worker, and my site was the library, the local library. I had a table there. A lot of people who came knew me from the library. The most common complaint was giving names. They didn't want to give their names, and they asked me, why do they need our names? And I didn't know why you need names, not just numbers.
Yeah, Anna, good question. So, Michael Moser, why does the federal government need to know the actual names of everybody, not just how many people are in the household and what ages they are, et cetera?
Well, I guess there's a couple reasons. I guess one of the responses would be so that, you know, in 70 years or so, when they release the data publicly, you'll be able to do your genealogical research, right? But that's not the real reason. The real reason is so that they can verify that the information is correct. And so they're, as I mentioned before, they use some administrative records and they're going to sort of cross-check all of the data and run it through processing. And they just want to make sure that what they're getting for information is the correct information.
So once they have all of our data, and again, it's not a lot of questions, at least not in the 2020 census, but they're going to have my name, they're going to have my age, they're going to have where I live and who lives in my household and what my race and ethnicity are. How does the federal government keep that safe?
That's a great question. I'll start by just pointing out that all of that information that you just mentioned is far less information than is collected about you every time you use your credit card, every time you go online and log into a website or something like that. So data is constantly being collected about all of us. And the Census Bureau is collecting these data. And as soon as they take in those data, it is protected by something called Title 13, which is the Census Bureau's privacy parameters. And essentially, Census Bureau employees and Census Bureau processing, they are not allowed to release personally identifiable information to any other government entity, including FBI, CIA. They are not going to do that. And that has been tested in the Supreme Court, the United States, on multiple occasions and has been upheld. They are not going to release those data, personally identifiable data, to corporations or any other individuals. So everything becomes locked down as soon as it's collected and put into the Census Bureau system. Even the person that comes to your house can be penalized for life if they reveal any personal information that they may have collected or, you know, when they were working as a Census Bureau employee.
Although it's worth pointing out that there has been at least one egregious violation of that idea of privacy when the census information was used for the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. So it's perhaps understandable why some without legal documentation might be hesitant at best at filling out the form.
So that is a story that happened. That is something that happened. And that took place before Title 13 was fully enacted. There were some privacy protections, but the Census Bureau is very sensitive to, remaining true to its promise to protect everyone's confidentiality.
Well, there's more to – yeah, Elliot, go ahead.
That we're concerned about in the Fraud Watch program, though, is that when people get either an individual coming to them or they get a phone call or an email asking for information, and it purportedly is from the Census Bureau, it looks very official. The folks who are creating these scams are skilled. They shouldn't be underrated in terms of what they can do. And they're looking for information, which we call phishing, Social Security numbers. They may ask for money. They may ask you for your political affiliation. They may ask for account numbers or income, mother's maiden name. These are things that the Census Bureau does not request in the decennial census. So if somebody starts to ask for those things, or if you're looking at a form online and it includes those, it's time to move away from that particular email.
Well, that's a good point, yeah. Elliot, and I'm going to cut you off there because we have to end this segment. But I'm glad that you pointed that out and ways that people should be thinking about this. And we'll continue to cover this as the 2020 census continues next year. Elliot Greenblatt is coordinator of AARP's Fraud Watch program in Vermont. Michael Moser is the coordinator of the Vermont State Census Data Center at UVM Center for Rural Studies. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
And we have another special VPR thing to tell you about today, one that we actually need your help with. Vermont Edition's other host, Bob Kinzel, is here with me now to tell you a little bit about that. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Jane.
So what we're talking about here is our annual music show. Almost every year, we have done a music show in December. And some years, we ask people to share the best new music of whatever year it is. But lately, we've been doing it a little bit differently. And we're asking people to share the music that sort of underscores their year. Can you explain a little bit more, Bob?
Absolutely. You know, it can be something, some music that came out this year, or maybe it's something that came out 20 years ago that has some significance for someone today. So that's really what we're looking for, is what song for you really represents some of your emotions or a particular event in 2019. And the song could be 200 years old or it could be 2 months old.
Yeah. So we're asking you, listeners, to submit your music of 2019 and whatever story goes along with it. And you can do that in a couple of ways. One way is to just send us an email with the name of the song and the story that you want to tell about it. But another way is to record your voice. We always love hearing your voices. So if you have a smartphone, you can actually record your voice using the free Memo app that comes with whatever phone you have, a short file, 30 seconds or so, and then you can send it to us. And you can email in either of those ways, vermontedition@vpr.org. And we will collate and collect all of those submissions questions. And Bob, I know over the years that we've done this, you have found that it really resonates with you. Can you talk a little bit about what people have discussed with us and the music that they've chosen?
Sure. People have been really forthright with us and telling us about some very emotional events in their life. It might be the birth of a child and a song that they heard that reflects that wonderful event for them. In some cases, it was a family member who had cancer, and there was a comforting song that the family could play for that person and became very identified with that situation. So it's, you know, Jane, it's just so incredible how music can reflect and trigger these very strong emotions and memories. And these things stay with us for our entire life. So there are folks who told us in the last year or two about some song that was connected to a very important life event. And I will bet you 10 years from now, when they hear that song, it's going to bring back a flood of memories of that event.
Yeah, you and I, Bob, I think both really value this show when we do it and find a lot of emotion welling up within us as well. The plan is to have this show next Friday, the 13th. So we need submissions by early next week if you're going to submit. But Bob, you're our resident House impeachment inquiry watcher. So there's a chance that we might not have the show on Friday, the 13th. But we still want people to submit, right?
Absolutely. We'd love to have people submit as soon as possible. And if the House impeachment hearings preempt us, we'll find another time for the program, because this is a great way for folks to share events and feelings in their life and show us how music has such an important impact on them.
Well, Bob, thanks. And I look forward to doing this show with you whenever we get to do it.
Me too, Jane.
And again, if you want to submit a song, you can send a voice memo or an email to Vermont Edition at vpr.org.